Session number 12708, Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 4.
Mr. R.W. Hawksworth, Reel 4. Did you pick up any other troops on your journey across to China, Mr. Hawksworth?
Yes, passing through the Red Sea, we call in at Port Sudan, where we collected some 200 men of the 2nd Battalion who were joining our battalion, having not served the full 6 years term of service overseas. And they came along with us to Shanghai. Amongst these soldiers were bandsmen, signalers, and other specialists, and they were a grand set of fellows.
They settled in pretty quickly?
Straight away. I can well remember some 16 or so bandsmen who came over, came down onto the mess deck, having been sent aboard, and immediately obtained tea and biscuits from the canteen and got the Ma Jiang set out.
When you got to China, what date was it?
I can't remember that date.
Do you recall your first impressions of Shanghai?
Oh, yes. That's a difficult question, really, to answer, but on account of the enormity of the situation, Shanghai was teeming with people of all nationalities, not necessarily Chinese. There were Sikh policemen at all the street junctions, wielding lathis against offenders, or would-be offenders. The old-fashioned manhole rickshaw was in vogue in those days. Equally prominent on the streets were the American Marines, wearing more medals than Montgomery ever had, smoking stogies.
What's a stogie? A
stogie is a green cigar, and smells just like that too. Shanghai was a marvellous place to be. It was known, as you may know, as the Paris of the East in those days. And there were also, of course, other British troops in the area at the time, as well as French, Italian, and I forget the other nation. There was an international concession in Shanghai, but the Italians were certainly there, and the French, the Americans, and ourselves. It was the only way I can describe it was a big city, a big place.
How did the Chinese receive you?
I don't think they were bothered. The main occupation, as far as I can recall, the main occupation as far as the Chinese were concerned was staying alive. The climate out there is one of extremes. We got there just in time to experience the first winter, and one aspect of Chinese was not life, it was death. In the morning, there was a regular patrol went round in the morning from the local civic authorities picking up the bodies off the streets that either died from hunger or exposure or a combination of the two.
What was the situation regarding the Japanese?
Japanese had been in the area, certainly in China, and in the area surrounding Shanghai, quite some time when we arrived there. And in the river, the Yangtze River, there were gunboats of various nationalities standing by in case immediate evacuation became necessary. The situation was tense, to say the least. And in fact, we experienced two or three areas whilst we were there. There were bombing hell out of various Chinese cities, not too far distant, and the well-documented rape of Nanking took place whilst we were there, and some of the pictures that came out were horrifying. So, yes, we were on a more or less a war footing. We had emergency positions, which we practiced taking up from time to time, and even we as bandsmen, as trained stretcher bearers, were put under arms more than once when the button was pressed.
Did you actually see and or experience any of the cruelties of the Japanese towards the Chinese?
I didn't, but certainly some of the battalion did. We were not engaged in patrol activities as such, being bandsmen and non-combatants. But as stretcher bearers, some of our fellows attended these patrols, and I've heard of instances where the Japs were on one side of the Suzhou Creek, which ran around Shanghai, and our chaps faced them on patrol duties, and there was no love lost, obviously, between the two. And the Japs would viciously ill-treat the itinerant passing Chinese person, usually women, in full view of our soldiers, and how some shots didn't get exchanged, I don't know to this day. But it certainly went on. And you may, in the course of your travels, hear from first experience from one of our fellows that these atrocities were committed. I've heard of cases where they've prodded people halfway across this creek on a plank and eventually off the end of the plank, at the end of the bayonet.
When you got off the ship, where did they take you?
Oh, there were no barracks as such available at the time. And we were taken and billeted in a school, Bubbling Well Road School, I well remember. I think it had been a sort of a girls' high-class school, previously occupied by an infantry battalion. I think it was Lancashire Fusiliers. And we went into Bubbling Well Road School. And to say it was overcrowded, to say that, you know, when we all got in there, but that's where we were until the proper barracks were ready for occupation.
How were you sleeping? What conditions were you living under there?
Pretty crowded. I was still on boys' service at the time, of course. Boys were always kept segregated, as was the rule. And I think we were sleeping something like 30 in a room, normally occupied by 12 or so girls at the school desks. Not that it bothered us much, we were all together, that's what it mattered. But the rifle company people were just as badly off, you know, and they were a great relief to get out on sentry duty elsewhere, patrol activity.
Were you lying on the floor?
No, we had beds. We had beds, but I seem to remember that some of the other fellow didn't. Not straight away anyway. There were. I think we arrived more than expected, numerically speaking.
How long were you there before you moved to the barracks?
I think 3 months, maybe four. Then we moved not far up the road to the barracks, a proper hutment barracks.
Do you recall the name of the barracks?
Yes, UUN Road.
And these were typical army barracks?
Yes, yes. They were mainly wooden huts, standing off the floor about 2 feet on concrete blocks on account of the slight flooding that was due to occur from time to time.
What kind of things were you doing then there, yourself?
Well, we were carried on with our normal band duties. The bandmaster introduced a weekly retreat parade for the entertainment value of the troops, and they seemed to lap it up. We always got a good audience. The officers' mess was a palatial affair over in the far corner of the barracks, nearer to the main road, a permanent proper building. And we played there every Thursday evening, regimental guest nights, as was our usual custom. And apart from the annoying moths and other flying achars that were attracted by the lights, life was quite pleasant. The usual sporting facilities were available. There was a huge square upon which we played softball, inviting the Yankees in on occasion, who taught us the game. But we had a good softball team at the time.
You mentioned the fact that you were a trained stretcher bearer. Had you done that training at this time or before this time?
We were, right from joining, I was in a first aid class. In fact, the whole of the band were trained as first aiders. and on a weekly basis, at least 4 hours were devoted to training in St. John Ambulance Brigade aspects of first aid. And our instructors were band NCOs who had passed the course and held the proper certificates. So that was quite interesting. I suppose I became a qualified first aider when I was 17 and a half or thereabouts.
And were these examinations set by the Army or through the Red Cross or the St. John's Ambulance Brigade, that kind of...
There were the standard St. John's Ambulance set PEAT exam papers with slight modifications. The, I suppose, St. John's Ambulance people wouldn't expect to be met with the bomb blast and shell fire injuries and battlefield casualties, as we were trained to do. And so that was an addition. But generally speaking, it was on par with the normal St. John's Ambulance procedures, examination.
Were you issued with a kind of traditional first aid pack which you carried with you?
No. Our responsibility in that field was purely in case of war. From time to time, of course, in and around the barracks and sometimes off duty outside. Our experiences of trained first aiders came in handy if civilians suffered an injury or something other, and occasionally this did happen. But we weren't issued, nor did we carry at any time in peacetime any first aid equipment. That came later.
You came of age, as it were, when you were in Shanghai.
Yes, I celebrated, if that's the proper word, my 18th birthday in Shanghai. And duly became a man on man service, and became a bandsman. That occasion was celebrated in fine style on the at the local canteen that evening with half the band present.
Was that a traditional kind of inauguration?
No, it was just a get together. The woodwind section, the clarinetists and the oboes and one or two others said, come along, we're off to have a birthday drink, and whipped me off to the Naffy that night. So we had a couple of hours celebration. Just an impromptu party.
So this also allowed you now to go out and drink, or?
Well, I'm in army jargon, having become a man overnight, I can now smoke, swear, climb over the fence when no one's looking, and do all these old nefarious things, you know. But I've never been a wild one, and I just took it for granted. Although I must admit, I started smoking as soon as I was allowed. I did. I took up smoking. Cigarettes out there were quite cheap, and I found, much to my delight, that I still had money left in my pocket at the end of the week to go to the canteen with.
What money were being paid?
I think with starters, I think my pay went up to 30 shillings a week.
And that was more than sufficient for your needs?
Well, we didn't need a lot. I didn't go out very much there, and by that time I was getting more interested in the band work, and I used to do a lot of individual practice with two or three other boys in the practice room, and I maybe went out only once a month. Everything one wanted, apart from chasing women, was available within the barrack confines. We had an excellent YMCA, as well as a naffy, table tennis, snooker tables, darts and all that sort of stuff. So I was content. I had everything I wanted in camp. We'd also been warned of the rife disease situation out there, and I bore that in mind all the time, and I think I did my thing at the time as well.
Was that an offence to catch something like VD?
Oh,
offense?
Yes, it was a punishable offence. Soldiers of good behaviour or normal behaviour were in receipt of what was known as special proficiency pay in those days, having earned it by nature of good conduct and being a good shot and a generally good soldier, and on recommendation by his platoon sergeant. If, however, a soldier in receipt of this extra money contracted venereal disease, then he immediately forfeited any claim to that, and some never regained it. So it was a severe punishment of offence.
Did the band play outside of the barracks? Did you have commitments there?
Yes, Shanghai in those days was noted for its race course. And I think, if I remember rightly, there were three British regiments out there at the time, one being the Seaforth Highlanders, who we used to beat up regularly on Saturday nights when the occasion presented itself. They had a pipe and drum band, of course. The identity of the other battalion I can't just remember, but the three bands, of course, including ours, played regularly on the race course at race meetings, and open air concerts were arranged for the benefit of the European community. The Italians participated with their band. There was a lot of musical entertainment, military band wise.
You mentioned battles with the Seaforth Highlanders. Was this a traditional occupation with the Derby?
Yes. I don't know. I think in those days, more so than now, from what I can gather from the serving soldiers, in those days, a bit of opposite number bashing did one good. A person was trained up to a certain pitch and had to give way somehow. We all weren't expert boxers. I seem to remember one well-favoured watering place in Shanghai called the Bowling Alley, which it was nothing to do with the bowling alley. It was the name of the cabaret, which was a favourite haunt of all the British soldiers. And Seaforth and the Durhams usually sat together until the time expired, and then there was a usually set to for no apparent reason. And when the Seaforth weren't there, the Italians took the brunt.
How did you get on with the Italians you mentioned and the other nations?
We didn't see much of them. I think since that time there's been a more equal fraternisation between the different countries, the armies of different countries, armies and navies and air forces. There's a more mixing. In those days, I think the idea was that the armies of different nationalities were there for a fixed purpose, and that was to protect the interests of their nationals in the concessions, and that's what they were there to do, and they didn't much bother about anything else. And possibly, if that sort of situation had been relaxed somewhat, there wouldn't have been this mayhem on a weekend basis.
You didn't go often into Shanghai town, but other than the places you mentioned, what other areas of leisure were popular?
In the town itself, the favourite place to go, if you weren't looking for a fight, was the Forum YMCA. It was a terrific place. I've never seen anything like it since. Forum YMCA, and that's where everyone met. Usually in civvies. It's the one place you're allowed to go in civvies. People applied for Foreign YMCA pass, and which proved your identity, and you could go in there on a day off if you had a day off, and we frequently did. You could go in there mid morning and come away at 10 o'clock in the evening, and everything was in the building for you: a swimming pool, a gymnasium. Terrific place it was. There was an indoor shooting range in the cellar. It was a marvellous place.
Did you get much opportunity to actually meet with the civilians?
I'm glad you asked that, because it's just racked my memory a bit that we had a community in Shanghai of, I think I should say, English people whose spouses were either out there in the coal business or the tobacco business or other businesses, shipping. There were lots of shipping people out there. Jardine and Matheson was a great name out there, and most of their employees were from the home country. And they used to invite the boys out for tea. I went out frequently as a boy. They looked after us. They didn't ask boilers, those people. They were very good to us. I often wonder what happened to them, you know, because a lot of people got badly knocked about when the Japs interned them up, I believe. But yes, and the officers, the people in, guests, civilians from the civilian community in. We had teams come in to play basketball and stuff like that. So we did mingle freely with them, and we're encouraged so to do.
Were there any other duties that you performed other than band duties?
Yes. There were points around the perimeter of Shanghai itself, which were manned by the soldiery, Italian, French and British, and mainly at points where the bridges spanned the creeks which abounded on the outside, you know, the perimeter of the city itself. And once again, we were facing the Japanese types across the other side of the barrier. It was an itchy finger period at that time, but that was the main external picket duty that was performed. We went out once. Our section of the band went out once as riflemen to a point somewhere along the river. Near a tobacco factory, actually, when the Japs were bombing the ships in the river, and that was my first air raid, long before the war started. Yeah.
How did you take to it, this first air raid?
I was frightened to death. So was everybody else, for that matter. Of course, a few of them, as people will, pretended they weren't affected at all, but they're all knocking at the knees when it finished. It was a bit frightening. We couldn't see what was happening. We were in these so-called splinter-proof shelters, but they dropped a lot of stuff, and there was a lot of stuff coming back at them from the ships. And I think the Augusta was in the river at that time, the American flagship, and she was sending tons of stuff up. I don't know if they knocked any Japs out. I hope they did.
And this was a time when the countries weren't at war with each other?
No, there was no war. This was the, as far as I'm concerned, the illegal occupation of parts of China by the Japanese Imperial Forces. And it's a pity that lots of people living today have never even heard of it, let alone forget about it. But I shall certainly never forget about it, and they've got away scot-free for doing it.
What other activities do you recall?
Oh, one which was of great interest to everyone concerned. The at least one company per week would be taken around the bounds of the international concession on a route march, accompanied by the band. We were lucky because we went out every time anybody went out and played them along and around. And occasionally we passed the French and the Italian bands. We didn't think much of them, but they were entitled to go around just as well as we were. But that was an interesting feature of our occupation.
You mentioned the Americans. Did you get pretty close to those people?
The Yanks didn't seem to want to get to know anybody else much. They were very much on their own. I think they were mainly Marines, the Yankee Marines, who imposingly wore medals for football, squash, darts, snooker and all the rest of it. In fact, they jingled as they went. We had one or two softball and baseball teams come into our barracks at Union Road, but that's about all. I can't remember any concert parties or other such arrangements being put on.
Was the food better than what you'd been getting in England and on the boat? Different, at least.
I can't remember much being much different. It was certainly good. We were well fed, and I suppose the appearance of different sort of vegetables occurred from time to time, which we usually got, you know, we got used to in time. But no, I don't think there was all that much different at all. The food was plentiful, and that's all that matters to a soldier, really. If there hadn't been, there'd have been a moan about that.
Did you stay in Shanghai?
We stayed about a year, I suppose, and then moved up to Tientsin, further up north.
What kind of date would this be?
You got me snookered there. I think the dates, The dates of arrival in Shanghai and our move from to Tientsin will be in David Rissick's book, which is a good reference book.
What was the difference, if any, between what you were doing in Shanghai and what you were doing in Tientsin?
The similar sort of arrangement. But Tientsin was a smaller town or city. It seemed to be a grey place to me, and I hardly ever went out of the barracks in Tientsin. The Japanese were right on our doorstep, more or less there, and they're not the usual run-of-the-mill duties occupying the men's time. The combat rifle companies, they were out on mobile patrols in trucks and on fixed patrols. There was one interesting duty which fell our part in Tientsin. That was a patrol that used to go up the river on some ships belonging to a local shipping company to a place called Tsingtao. Tsingao. I never thought I'd remember that. But they used to go up on these little ships, and they were fed and well liquefied by the crews. This was a much sought after duty. That was a good. I never been a bandsman, of course, but that's something we missed out on. But that was an additional task, which was a good one.
What was the reason for the battalion being at Tientsin?
Well, there again, it was a concessionary protection job. There was a British community there, as there had been in Shanghai. There was a similar arrangement, an international concession, I think the word is, settlement. The Italians featured again and were similarly dealt with on Saturday evenings in suitable areas. And yes, it was a similar arrangement, but we saw more of each other as soldiers because there were fewer civilians knocking about. And I think I know that the Chinese there were having a hell of a hard time. They were in a hard time. The Japs were stopping a lot of stuff coming in. And I don't know to this day what difficulties our logistic people had in getting materials in to keep the troops well fed and clothed. They must have had a hell of a job on. But did it, they did. And as I say, the Chinese people were just hanging on by a thread.
Was the whole of the band in Tientsin?
Yes, we were all there.
And you were doing the same ceremonial kind of thing?
Yes, we did, despite the severe winter, and it's pretty cold out there. In fact, it's hellishly cold out there in the winter. We did the same, we did the usual parades, we did our retreats, we did church parades, and the occasional military funeral, I'm sad to say. An idea of the cold, the extreme of the cold, would be that on one occasion, returning from a funeral, all the slide instruments froze up and wouldn't operate. The trombone slide wouldn't work, and the cornet valve froze up. And despite the obscene entreaties from the adjutant, the instrument still wouldn't blow. Then he was told where to get off of it.
That's true, yes. Yeah. You mentioned funerals. What did happen to the people?
Well, I think this was a Corporal Scott who died from some illness, natural cause, I believe, and we buried the chap in on the local cemetery. We had a military plot, I suppose, in the corner somewhere. But we marched there in slow time, quite a distance too, and came back at the gallop. But as I say, the instrument froze up. I think Corporal Scott died in hospital. It certainly was not through any enemy action or interference in that manner.
Were you getting mail in China from home?
Oh, quite regularly. The mail service was quite good. We had it. The bugler would sound the mail call daily, and the orderly NCOs would collect it. Yes, the mail service was quite good.
And were you getting letters from home regularly?
Oh yes, at least once a week from either my mum and dad or one of my sister's brother, and uncles and aunts were writing through. I think I was the first one ever to get as far away from home as far as the fortune was concerned.
And were these the days before censorship?
Oh yes, yes. I think it was towards the end of our stay in Tientsin that the green envelopes arrived on the scene, in one which had to declare that, to the best of his knowledge, that he hadn't transgressed or, you know, put anything in he should not. But they went open by the censor.